Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, Life Incorporated. How the world became a corporation and how to take it back. My guest is Douglas Rushkoff. He's an author, scholar, documentarian, and that is his new book, examining the very corporatization of our everyday life. You do want to stay tuned. So we live in a world where we're pretty much indoctrinated and completely surrounded by the logic of the market, by the logic of economic commerce, by the logic of the corporations which surround us and seem to have a role in every aspect of our lives, to such an extent to which it's almost impossible to step back and get a look about and see how the world would be different. And this permeates so many areas, including the media, to the extent to which it also gets in between the way we relate to one another. And in some parts of our everyday lives, some might say that's a problem. Douglas Rushkoff, author, is a person who would say that's a problem and shows why it's a problem. But not just why, but how we got there. This is a little different interview for Media Geek, since it's not explicitly media related, but Douglas Rushkoff has been a media maker for most of his career and currently espouses a very grassroots, bottom-up form of organizing, of action, and media making. He is a radio host. He produces a radio program at the great community station WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. And that program is called The Media Squat, and it is also available online. You can get it as a podcast or listen on the radio or listen live. So there's a lot of similarities between Doug's approach and the approach here on Media Geek. So this is a interview in two parts. We're going to air part one this week and part two next week. But to get started, Doug starts to explain exactly where this corporatism comes from and why it's in some ways so hard to see.
I mean, it's hard for people to, for anybody who is born into a world where, you know, you get a job, you work for some company, you get some money, you put that money in the bank or invested in things and hope that they do well and work until you hit retirement and then have a bunch of savings. It's hard to think of that reality as anything other than a pre-existing condition, that's just, you know, the rules of the world, that we live in a competitive universe, a dog-eat-dog world, that, you know, whether you believe in evolution or not, you know, it's tough out there. And that we're all individuals, you know, fighting for our piece of the pie. I don't fault people for thinking that's just the way things are, because not only were they born into a world where that's the way things seem to be, you know, those are the circumstances into which we're born. But, you know, we have both our left and our right politicians and policymakers, and our smartest economists are just telling us this is how things are. You know, so it's hard to consider that these rules, that these customs were invented at a particular period in history, and that they weren't invented. It's not a system that was invented to help people create and exchange value and live meaningful, productive lives. You know, it was a system that was invented, you know, by just a few people at a very difficult moment in history, when the wealthiest and most powerful people who had lived through the Middle Ages as lords were under siege. You know, they were threatened by a rising merchant class. They were threatened by what what you would actually call a free economy. They were threatened by the fact that merchants were traveling around and finding great stuff and selling it, that people were working the land and using currencies that they really devised themselves that were based on the grain that they had brought in from the fields. They had an economy that was really based in the abundance of people's ability to create value. And that was a real problem for people who had traditionally maintained their wealth by exploiting other people. You know, they were losing their reins on society. So they invented an operating system, really, that was devised to help wealthy people stay wealthy simply by being wealthy. You know, an operating system based on artificially scarce markets rather than actually abundant marketplaces. And, you know, the two main inventions they came up with, you know, were the chartered corporation, which has come down to us now as the corporation, and centralized coin of the realm, which has come down to us as central banking and central currency. But for us, it's like, you know, waking up in a world where, you know, every single computer in the world just had Microsoft Windows on it. You know, you wouldn't know that there were other operating systems that may have worked in other ways. You wouldn't know about open source or Linux or anything else. You know, if enough generations just go by with the economy working by the rules that were set down in the late Middle Ages, you would think of that as the economy rather than an economic scheme.
Well, you locate, you know, roughly speaking, the location of this origin of the corporation of centralized currency is the Renaissance. And the times before the Renaissance, at least in Europe, I mean, we collectively know as the Dark Ages.
Right. I mean, it's funny. It's anytime I talk about the late Middle Ages and what was going right during that period of time, people say, oh, you want to go back to the Dark Ages? Don't you know there was a plague? It was a horrible time. And, you know, it ends up really devolving into an argument about whether the Middle Ages were fun or not. You know, and that's not really my point. The point is not that the Middle Ages were better than what we have now, or that, you know, the Renaissance was all bad and everything before it was all good. It's really just to say that there were functioning markets, that there was a huge surge in population growth. There was a tremendous abundance of food. There was a very short work week for people. They were working 4 days a week. They were eating, you know, four meals a day. They were, you know, women were taller in late Middle Ages Europe than they were till like the 1990s. I mean, there were some great things going on. It was a society that was really coming back from feudalism, from some really dark times. You know, the Middle Ages was 10 centuries. There were some good ones mixed in with the bad ones. But, you know, the Renaissance really was, or the beginning of the Renaissance was when the prosperity that people were starting to find in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries was when that was shut down, when local currencies were made illegal, when you had to work for a corporation rather than for yourself, you know, when basically the monarchy and big business got together and came up with new rules to lock in place the people who were then at the top, and really to prevent the kinds of class mobility that were threatening, you know, the status quo. People of the Renaissance and the historians of the Renaissance did a really good job at painting the Renaissance as the salvation of our civilization and the late Middle Ages as a dark age, which no one really uses the term dark ages anymore. That, you know, the responsible historians have really wiped that out now. But we still tend to think of it that way. We don't realize that the plague, you know, the thing we all associate with the Middle Ages, the plague actually came, the real big plague that we talk about It broke out 30 years after the invention of centralized currency in France and the illegalization of local currencies. People were forced, instead of being able to work on open lands and do subsistence farming, they had to go to the city to get a job in a workshop for some big company. They worked more hours. They didn't have good food. They were working in dirty cities and then trying to commute back home whenever they could. And they couldn't grow food on these fields anymore because the wealthy had locked them up. And, you know, the economy tanked and then people got sick. You know, so that, and then we start, we repaint that a few centuries later, you know, after half of the population of Europe has died from the plague. You know, now there's a few wealthy families that decide to fund some artists, you know, and we say, oh, look at the great Renaissance when these wonderful wealthy families became patrons of the arts and allowed Leonardo and Michelangelo to do these wonderful things. Well, you didn't need a patron before the Renaissance. You could just be an artist. You know, the fact that you needed a patron to be an artist is not a sign of a good civilization. It's a sign of a sold-out civilization. You know, it's just like today. It's like it's very hard to be an artist if you don't have Philip Morris or somebody funding, you know, or some other giant family foundation funding your work. You know, we live in a very similar age where most value that's created, you know, rolls back to the center or up to the top and is extracted from the people who are actually doing anything.
Well, and you can put the same question to those 15th century patrons of the art as you can to any foundation today. Okay, it's wonderful that you're sharing your largesse in pursuit of art or pursuit of other humanistic endeavors. How did that great mass of money get there in the first place?
Right. How did it get there in the first place, which is usually some horrible thing? You know, the best foundations are usually ones from, you know, the grandchildren of the people who have made money through the most rapacious forms of venture capitalism, you know, known, whether it's the railroad tycoons or the coal people, you know, people who killed, you know, hundreds of laborers end up creating the great foundations today. You know, not only that, but what does it take to maintain the endowments that these foundations have? You know, the LA Times did a terrific expose a couple of years ago on the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation, where they looked at, well, what kinds of companies and investments are all those billions of dollars in the foundation invested in? And it turns out, you know, the companies that the endowment, that the foundation invests in order to keep its money growing, are doing the very things that the foundation is trying to stop. You know, so you have to then wonder, well, is the foundation earning enough interest to undermine the activities of the companies who are paying that interest? I'm not really sure that they are. You know, and it's not like that charity is a bad thing or foundations are a bad thing. I mean, I'm still, you know, conservative enough to think I'd rather there be, you know, a MacArthur Foundation to find people and give them genius grants and do good things. You know, without any foundations now, there'd be almost nothing. But it's a stopgap, a compensatory measure of a larger system that is itself dysfunctional. You know, the larger ecosystems that corporatism is destroying are not going to be saved with a grant here and a grant there. You know, the larger systems are only going to be restored with a fundamental, you know, rebooting of our economic rule set.
Well, one of the things you chart in the book is how this corporatist logic, you know, what we might also call market logic, or the logic of free markets, has insinuated itself into most aspects of everyday life. And perhaps you can, you know, give an example of an aspect of maybe modern life that is sort of maybe even surprisingly completely overwhelmed by this logic.
Well, I mean, one is our you know, relationship to home ownership. You know, it's funny, the word home, until really the 1960s, the word home always meant the place that you're from. You know, your home is New York, your home is Phoenix, your home is that, you know, little village west of London. You know, it's only in the last few decades that home has meant that freestanding structure that you and your family have a mortgage on. You know, you think, that's my home. You know, that redefinition of place as property. You know, it took a few centuries to happen, but it's taken hold. And through no fault of our own, perhaps, although maybe I think it's some fault of our own, we end up kind of behaving in a corporatist fashion ourselves when we have really relationships to the bank and to money and to investment, the same kinds of relationships that corporations do. You know, a couple of years ago when I was just starting on this book, I got mugged outside my apartment in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which I thought of as at the time, you know, a nice lefty place or people who care about each other. And, you know, I was a renter in a place where a lot of people were owners, so I might have had a slightly different perspective on this neighborhood that I, you know, was still trying to raise enough funds to get a down payment to get one of those ridiculous mortgages that no one can pay back now. But I got mugged in front of my building. I went back inside and I posted what had happened to me on the Park Slope Parents List, which is this nice lefty, you know, crunchy list of parents who are, you know, trying to exchange breastfeeding strategies and, you know, how to grow organic cauliflower or whatever. And the first two emails I got in response to my announcement, to my neighborhood warning, were from homeowners angry that I had posted the street on which I had gotten mugged because this could negatively affect their property values. And neither of these people, from what I could tell, were even thinking of selling their homes that week. It's not like their house was on the market, so they were concerned with, you know, that now their block is going to be looked at as bad. You know, these were people who had mortgages that they were going to need to refinance in a year or two, because the way mortgages work is you get a mortgage more than you can afford, and then if your property value is going up, then you can get another mortgage for a lower percent of the total price of the house, which helps you sort of own more of the house over time, even though you can't ever quite pay down all this interest that you owe. And these people's ability to stay in their house was really predicated on the brand value of Park Slope going up, and going up rapidly. And they ended up caring more about the short-term asset value of their homes as property, you know, as mortgage fodder, than they cared about the experiential value of their neighborhoods as communities. And even if they were looking at it from a long-term economic perspective, you know, protecting the brand of your neighborhood, you know, against a bad mugging report in the short term is not a good way to keep your neighborhood safe and a place that people want to live in the long term. You know, you can only hide from reality for so long. You know, the way to make a neighborhood worth more is to, you know, have a real conversation, create a neighborhood watch, find out who is it that's coming here to mug us, why are they so mad at us, why are they looking at Park Slope as the place to come to mug people. I mean, you start looking at the real questions, you can actually get somewhere.
And you're listening to an interview with Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of the new book, Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. And you can learn more about Douglas and his many works at his website, rushkoff.com, RUSHKOFF.com. And this is Media Geek, media freedom, and our right to communicate. So now we continue with my interview with Douglas Rushkoff. How do we turn this ship around? The interesting thing about your book is that I would say while your critique is stinging, one cannot easily characterize it as a left-wing critique. And then I would say that in some ways, and it's explicit in your book, that you know, you have some critique from many of the institutionalized left-wing responses towards corporatism.
Right. I mean, I think the problem is that it's in the formulation of the question, and I ask it also. I mean, I'm just as guilty. It's the idea of how do we turn this ship around? You know, the fact is it's not a ship. You know, it's lots of individuals and neighborhoods and communities that you actually, the only people that turn ships around are captains, and captains are parts, are at the top of huge top-down institutions, you know, a ship with a crew that's going to move around the sails and move that whole big thing, you know, and that's the way, you know, someone like Obama, who is still a fan of administration. You know, that's the way he looks at the country. How are we going to turn this ship around? Through a big plan, you know, we're going to fund this or fund that bank and bail out this thing. You know, the way that we restore a transactional economy is by doing it one town at a time. You know, it's individual towns that need to return to local commerce. You know, that's why I had to go back in history and see, well, what did this system replace? What did centralized currency replace? It replaced local currencies. What did giant top-down corporate monopolies replace? They replaced local merchants. You know, it's not that, you know, having Del Monte can and ship food 3,000 miles across the country, it's not that that's more efficient than growing stuff locally through a CSA. It's that it's been made more efficient by the rewriting of laws in favor of big agriculture. You know, so if your laws are plastic, if your laws can be written to favor a giant company that's going to make stuff in an awful, non-nutritious way and use gas and oil and interstate highway systems and all that, we are subsidizing big agriculture, right? It's not that it's cheaper. It's that it's cheaper for them, mm-hmm, because we're paying them to do it in this way. You know, McDonald's, it's cheaper to buy a meal at McDonald's, a non-nutritious meal at McDonald's, than a nutritious meal somewhere else. Not because the nutritious meal, or not just because the nutritious meal is higher quality. The McDonald's meal actually costs more in terms of long-term devastation to the planet, in terms of the health costs of eating that way. It's that 90% of the potatoes grown on the planet at this point are being grown for McDonald's French fries. They have efficiencies that have been built into agriculture by policies that favor this kind of you know, destruction of you know, rainforests in South America and redistribution of water in America. You know, we end up using tax money to make it cheap to mass produce bad food, when if you look at the entirety of the business situation, it's actually cheaper to buy from your community supported agriculture.
But yeah, it's that policy angle which is, I think, what turns the question into the boat metaphor, right? It's because these decisions get made in a roughly centralized sort of fashion. It's very easy to see the problem as how do we change policy and how do we get the laws written back in order to no longer favor that or subsidize that way of being, which, right, I think is, you know, so how do we balance that reality?
I think the only way to do it is by beginning to do it from the bottom up and then changing the laws that we need to change from the bottom up in order to do what we need to do. So if there's a farm here, a community-supported agriculture farm that needs more land in order to grow enough food to feed everybody who wants to now subscribe to their good organic grass-fed, you know, agricultural products. You know, the land that they need to use now to grow more chard and Brussels sprouts is land that was set aside by the corn industry to as a corn subsidy land. So in theory, this is land that either needs to grow corn or has to be let just sit there. If you try to grow something else on that land, you have to pay a fine. That's a screwed up rule. So what we're doing now with the local farmers trying to figure out, how do we get that rule changed? You know, and we don't have to go to Obama for that. You know, you go to your state legislature. You know, you start with and there's policymakers at lower levels, at local and assembly and even congressional level, that are in some cases literally twirling their thumbs. They wish they had people coming and actually presenting them with actionable issues, instead of just getting spammed by the latest right wing or Move On petition for some, you know, giant top down issue like, you know, single payer healthcare and all that.
What about civil disobedience?
It works. When you got it, you got it. I mean, and that's a great way to get publicity for something too. You just grow the damn chard. You just put the solar panel on your roof, even though, you know, the local utility company has a monopoly on energy creation and doesn't want to let you supplement what you're getting from them with something from the sun. You know, if you're not allowed to catch rainwater, well, just catch the rainwater. Yeah. And then if you know your sheriff and you know your local judge, you know, that's how it starts. You know, that's how real revolutions happen. You know, and it's I'm not saying revolutions with guns. I mean, when a place just says, no, you know, this is not how we want to live. And it's hard. You know, it's really hard. You know, this has been going on in America really since pretty much since Abraham Lincoln's day is when it really started to take effect, when corporations got the rights of people and when they realized that all you need to do is hire a better lawyer than a municipality does. And then, you know, the whatever Pacific Railroad Company has a right to, you know, build a track and put, you know, buy all the land in a town, even though the town doesn't want it to happen. You know, when corporate rights are supersede state rights and municipal rights, those are the kinds of things that we got to fight back on. But I think it's important that we fight back from a place of not just political activism, but real world needs and insights, that once you start working this in the abstract is when it's really hard to make any sense or get any traction. And once you're doing it for real, you know, like a Sustainable South Bronx project, you know, which looked at the fact that this one area, Hunts Point in the Bronx, had, you know, like 90% of the waste dumps for New York City were put there, and all the kids are dying and everyone's getting asthma and cancer, and, you know, everybody's stabbing each other because the highways go right through the neighborhood in a way that creates real divisiveness and it's impossible to have community. You know, they got together and they really did get their representatives to fight for very specific, grounded and concrete things to change their community. And it is easier to do that as a community than it is for us to say, oh, this is the problem with urbanization in America, so what we need is, you know, HUD to go and create a new kind of policy that changes this whole big thing. I mean, and out of those best intentions, you end up getting things that don't really work right.
And that is Douglas Rushkoff. He is the author of the new book, Life Incorporated: How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. It is available in bookstores now. You can learn more about Douglas at Rushkoff, RUSHKOFF.com. And that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views in our media environment, along with part two of my conversation with Douglas Rushkoff, getting more into the media and radio. In the meantime, go to MediaGeek.net, the radio shows at radio.mediageek.net, and of course the Twitter feed, twitter.com/MediaGeek. And if you got comments, I do want to hear them, paul@MediaGeek.net. Media Geek is heard on great stations like CJUM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and KRFP. Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. And Media Geek is produced live here at WNUR in Evanston and Chicago, Illinois. Thanks for tuning in.